Hi there, Outspoken Cyclist listeners. Greg Priddy here. I wanted to take just a minute or so before we start this week's show to answer a question that at least a few of you have been asking lately. Namely, where has Greg been? What you may not know about me is that I've been doing radio here at WJCU for a number of years, and The Outspoken Cyclist is the third show I've worked on. My role has always been that of a technical producer, which is basically the person who makes sure everything sounds right and worries about the technical details of the show. When Diane started this show 2.5 years ago, she invited me to share some of the on-air duties in addition to my technical responsibilities. However, as time went on, I decided that I preferred to work behind the scenes, so that's where I've returned. And with that administrative business out of the way, let's get started with this week's Outspoken Cyclist. Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists, for cyclists, and now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Leeds.
Good evening and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Leeds. Thanks for joining me. Tonight's show is especially diverse, ranging from cargo bikes to mountain biking in Afghanistan to the genius of Professor Emeritus Les Ernest. I'm going to begin with Les Ernest. In his own words, Dr. Ernest says he grew up in San Diego as a bicycling beach boy and got himself an FBI record at the age of 11 as a result of dabbling in cryptography. He graduated from Caltech in 1953, became a naval aviation's electronics officer. While at MIT and MITRE Corp in the late 50s, he helped design the first computer network. In the 60s, Les was the Stanford representative on the startup committee for ARPANET. And in the 70s, he helped arrange funding for the Stanford project that produced the Internet protocols. Along the way, he created the first spelling checker and with his colleagues initiated development of the first search engine, first autonomous road vehicle, first document compiler with spreadsheets, first network news service, first computer-controlled vending machines, first social networking and blogging services, and first desktop publishing systems using laser printers. As if that wasn't enough, which evidently it wasn't, and along with a gentleman by the name of John McCarthy, Les organized and managed the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab, SAIL, which became a hotbed of innovation that produced dozens of commercial spin-offs, some of them very successful. So what does all this have to do with bicycling? Oh, well, Les also led the fight for reform of the U.S. bicycle racing against crooked businessmen and dopers, a task, in his words, that is not yet complete. Les is my guest this evening. We'll talk about reforming cycling, what he's doing to take those who have broken the rules to task. He should well know about those rules since he developed many of them as USA Cycling was just forming in the 1990s. Then we're going to head out to Colorado, to Breckenridge exactly, and you may remember my story about Shannon Galpin, who was featured on NBC Nightly News' Making a Difference last week. Shannon's work with young women mountain bike and road bike racers in Afghanistan is just one of the projects she has on her plate. Her nonprofit, mountaintomountain.org, is reaching back into the U.S. to help women here, too. Shannon will be with me a little later in the show. And to top it off, our third guest this evening is Ben Sarrazin. He's the founder and owner of Yuba Cargo Bikes. He was born in France, grew up around bicycles, and has brought his enthusiasm and ideas back to the U.S. with his innovative ideas about transportation and bicycles. So we have three heaping servings tonight, plus some news for dessert. I'll get right to it. It is my privilege to welcome Professor Les Ernest to The Outspoken Cyclist. Good evening, Les. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure.
Well, you're a scientist. You've done some pretty amazing things in your career. How did bicycling become part of all this work that you do?
Well, I got sucked into it in the early 70s by my sons who took up racing. I'd been a bike rider since 1933, but never got into racing on my own until they introduced me to it. and I had at the racing, discovered that the officiating was not all that good, so I volunteered to do that, and that meant I had to read the rule book, discovered that it was an awful mess, and I then volunteered to rewrite it and was invited to do so by U.S. Cycling Board, and I kept getting deeper into the sport over time.
I'll say. Well, what first caught my attention was the article you wrote about team owner Tom Wiesel, but I don't want to get to that yet. I really want to hear more about it. Can you fill me in a bit on the backstory of the governing bodies of cycling and what you began to see as you got more involved with it? It was the USCF in those days, right?
Yeah, well, it was actually ABLA when I first got involved, Amateur Bicycle League of America.
Okay.
ABLA.
Right.
It had been in power roughly since World War II. If you go way back, the governing bodies of bike racing over the years have been largely corrupt in one way or another. There was the first one was formed, I think, in the 1870s, and then they consistently refused to have bike races on Sunday, which annoyed many cyclists. So a group in San Jose, California, initiated a rebellion and jumped to another existing organization, which had been organized by track owners, velodrome owners. That turned out to be a big mistake because they were running it in their financial interest and controlled the sport accordingly. So things went along that way for a while. Eventually, a New York group formed an independent association, which became the ABLA, and slowly gained control of the amateur part of the sport. The professional sport was still thriving. It was being run in velodromes. The so-called six-day bike races were held all over the country.
Right.
And drew big crowds. But they were manipulating the results to suit their financial interests. And people eventually figured that out. I should say that at the turn of the preceding century, cycling was more popular as a sport than any other, including, of course, baseball, football, basketball. And the top-level participants were highly esteemed by the public. But that faded under the control of this velodrome group. And by the beginning of World War II, that part of the sport had collapsed. And as a result, the NCA, the old association that was running it, essentially disappeared, and this new group, the ABLA, took control. Now, it started as strictly an amateur cycling group, but eventually they were supposedly given control of the professional part of the sport in the early 60s, I believe it was. No, mid-60s. But the paperwork got shuffled, and consequence was that another group took over the professional aspect and came to be called PRO, Professional Racing Organization.
So that was in the 60s?
Yeah.
Okay, so you had the ABLA, you had the PRO
operating
at the same time?
Yeah, and also NORBA, the
right.
off-road. And in the meantime, two BMX organizations got started independently. So there was a whole slew of them. Now, in the late 70s, the one that was financially best off was ABLA, which changed its name to U.S. Cycling Federation because they thought they were taking control of the professional part of the sport. Turns out they were. They were conned.
Yeah, they were because they were the USCF is what all the clubs belong to. It's what all of the amateurs belong to.
Yeah. Well, the initial result of all that was there were a series of lawsuits between PRO and USCF that went nowhere. USCF had enough money to buy Norba. Norba had been mismanaged into financial mess. And finally, in 1993, I initiated a proposal to bring all of these pieces together into one organization and drafted proposed bylaws and articles of incorporation to do that. Got them before the board of directors, before the annual meeting in 1993. Some people in USCF didn't like that proposal because, among other things, I had democratic representation for all the participants, and the commercial interests wanted to control everything.
So who were these commercial interests? Are we talking corporations or individuals? Who were these people?
Well, the PRO people, who didn't have much money either, were some of them. Mike Plant had gotten control, who incidentally worked for Turner Broadcasting.
Okay.
Had gotten control of part of the organization. There was some evidence that somebody was using payola to influence staff members of USCF.
To do what?
To fix my proposal.
Ah, I see.
What happened first was, the first year, suddenly at the last minute, the issue was raised that my proposal for this new organization had not been reviewed by the corporate attorney. Well, of course, the corporate attorney didn't work for me. He worked for the executive director.
Sure.
And the executive director had never told him to look at it. So that was a phony blockage, but it worked. The proposal was tabled. I brought it back the next year, slightly revised, still with democratic representation. I contacted the executive director, asked her to be sure to have the corporate attorney review it. She had told me to give it to her associate for distribution to the board of directors. I was going off for a month in Europe at that point. When I got back, I discovered that it had not been distributed. Instead, it was handed to one director who wanted to fix it. And she had handed it over to a smart cycling official who recruited an attorney, and they reformed it in such a way that commercial interests representing less than 2% of the membership would have a majority of the board of directors.
Aha. Let me take a moment and remind our listeners, we're speaking with Professor Les Ernest. He's in, you're in California.
True.
And we are talking about the history of the organizations of pro cycling and amateur cycling in the U.S., and we're going to pretty quickly here fast forward it to what's happening right now, which doesn't seem to be a lot different from what happened then.
True. It's been a long pull through a mess. Incidentally, I'm not a professor.
Oh, you're not? I thought you were Professor Emeritus.
No, I'm a Senior Research Computer Scientist Emeritus.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Although for some reason, Stanford always sends me mail addressed to professor. I don't know what.
You're still pretty smart as far as I can tell. So the USCF, it became USCF at some point. We have 2% of the board of directors who are now like all the financial interests. So basically, you said that there was a flagrantly crooked takeover of business interests in an essay. So
true.
If that's what's happened, is that still the way it is?
Yes.
Aha.
It actually got worse.
Okay.
It was just 2% of the membership that took control of the majority of the board initially.
Okay.
I made several subsequent attempts to amend the bylaws to fix that problem. Each time there was some kind of a mistake in the ballot assembly that somehow So it came out making no sense. I had gotten on the ballot an amendment that would fix the problem. The ballot was sent out with the argument in favor of the very unbalanced representation and with my amendment, but the argument in favor of my amendment was left off the ballot.
Oh, just by chance, I'm sure, right?
Just by chance, yes. Yeah. And, that same kind of problem was repeated the following year. And this was all done by staff members. So I'm pretty sure they were clearly under the control of the commercial interests. They should not have been. That's why I'm suspecting Paola, but don't have any proof.
Right. So who is Tom? Was it Wiesel or Wiesel?
Wiesel, right.
Yeah, and how is he involved in all this? And now we're kind of fast forwarding to current day USA Cycling, which is, so it's no longer called the USCF. It's USA Cycling, but evidently things aren't much different.
Well, it actually was called USA Cycling as part of the reform that I initiated.
I see. Okay.
But it got seriously distorted. The next step was in 1999 when Mike Plant, the president of USA Cycling and a definite commercial interest, got amendments put on the board of directors ballot, but it was kept secret until the people arrived at the meeting. And they were told this was an emergency measure that had to be adopted immediately. And a majority of the board stupidly did that. As soon as I heard about that, I knew it was an illegal action, and I initiated a lawsuit, which took 2 years. I won on appeal. Incidentally, part of the of that revised bylaws was it was less than 1% of the membership that now controlled the board of directors, a majority of the board. Less than 1% who all represented commercial interests.
Well, so when you say commercial interests, are we talking sponsors?
No, mostly race promoters of various sorts.
Okay.
And, and one of the people who was brought in at that point on the board was Tom Wiesel.
Okay. And he was the owner of a team. For which Lance Armstrong...
Tailwind wrote. Sports,
right.
That owned U.S. Postal Service team,
right.
With Lance Armstrong, the most successful big doping team in the sport. Now, I should mention that this was actually Wiesel's second takeover. He had earlier taken over downhill skiing, alpine skiing, as the Olympic sport, in a manner similar to what he did to USA Cycling. He had put together a, quote, charitable nonprofit corporation called the USA Cycling Development Foundation, had gotten his financier buddies to make tax-deductible contributions to this nonprofit, and then used it as a political action committee to take over the sport of cycling. And he succeeded at that. And he had done, as I say, a similar thing to alpine skiing earlier. Meanwhile, another thing that he had done much earlier was he was one of the early investors in Amgen Corporation,
uh-huh.
Which later made EPO, the blood doping drug.
Which also sponsors a huge event, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, the Tour of California.
Right, right. So it very interesting. So is Tom Wiesel still involved in all of this?
He's still in control of USA Cycling.
I see.
What he did was put his employees into all the key positions, so they still take orders. The current president is a fellow who has worked for him for many years, and so on. He still runs it. He should be booted out, but hasn't happened yet.
So what do you see as the future for the sport?
Well, what I'm working on currently is to try to fix not just cycling, but all the Olympic events, right? Aim high.
Why not?
I believe that there is a federal law, the most recent version of which is called the Ted Stevens Olympic and Amateur Sports Act, that has a couple of major errors in it that have enabled this commercial takeover. One is it imposes no requirement for democratic representation of participants in the sport. That allows things like what has happened in USA Cycling, in which a group that represents a tiny number of participants who have commercial interests to take over the whole thing. They use their financial leverage to do so. Another thing that is wrong is that it does not explicitly prohibit the use of athlete suspensions to prevent competition. One of the things that USA Cycling is doing is if a cyclist wants to participate in a race run by a competing organization, they tell him he's going to be suspended. Now, that would make sense if he was an employee of theirs, but he isn't. He's being controlled by USA Cycling in a monopolistic way, and that should be prohibited by law. Now, arguably, it is prohibited by law, but we did make one lawsuit out of that and lost it. We may try it again. But so tentatively, what I would like to do is to amend the Olympic Sports Act to fix these two problems. One is require democratic representation of the participants, therefore no longer under control of commercial interests, and also prohibiting the monopolistic practice of suspending riders who enter competing events.
So if those things happen, and you have to sort of go up the ladder in cycling, you've got the UCI, which has its own problems, and then you have the International Olympic Committee. This has to sort of happen in an international way, not just in the United States.
Well, fortunately, U.S. law takes precedence over the regulations of UCI and the International Olympic Committee, at least as far as events in the U.S. are concerned.
Okay, I see.
So that doesn't solve the international problem, but it does solve the domestic problem here.
So what do you think the chances are of having these two laws put into place, or these two ideas put into place?
Well, it's a little early to tell.
Okay.
We're just getting started.
Okay.
We have a study group going on cycling. I'm hoping that we can get some other groups going on other sports and that we can then converge on a strategy and round up the necessary votes in Congress to pass it. This will be a challenging undertaking because there's big bucks on the other side.
Yeah,
but it's worth a try, I think.
Well, you know, everybody's talking about wanting to clean up the sport, so it would be nice to clean it up on all levels, not just doping, but on the rules and the regulations and who is really controlling things. Obviously, if corporate money is controlling cycling, doping's going to stay there because those people want their winners.
Yep.
So it's kind of...
In fact, the current style of doping is not the end of the problem. As technology moves forward, if we want to have a level playing field, that is fair competition, we have to keep moving on rule enforcement. One of the things that's definitely coming sooner or later is genetic engineering. that will allow parents to design their kids with particular skills. And we have to figure out the extent to which that will be allowed.
Well, that's kind of scary.
Yes.
That's actually terrifying.
But you can see it's going to come.
Yes, I can. You're absolutely right. It never even occurred to me until you said that. Uh-huh. Wow. Wow. So what can we look for? What's going to happen in the near term? Is there something we can see in the near term that we can follow?
Well, as I say, I'm hoping that a change in the federal law can level the current playing field and get rid of the commercial interests in controlling the sport. You can think of this, incidentally, as another Occupy movement. It's the same vein as what is being attempted in certain financial fields. That is, we're trying to boot out the commercial interests that are running many parts of our world in ways that should not be done.
Well, this has just been fascinating, and I want to reserve the right to talk to you again as things progress. So I'd like to end it right there. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but I really appreciate you talking to me about this. I'm going to keep my eye on it, and I know my listeners are going to be very interested to know what's going to happen in the future. So I appreciate very much talking to you this evening, Les.
You're welcome.
Thank
my
you.
Pleasure.
All righty. Have a good night.
Right. Bye.
Bye-bye. Les Ernest spoke with me from his offices at Stanford University in Palo Alto area of California. I, for one, will be watching this with great interest. He is a really interesting man. We are going to take a short break on The Outspoken Cyclist. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
What if we got rewarded for every good decision?
Dinner. Meal needs a vegetable. Check.
Amazing!
Vegetables cooked with a healthier oil instead of butter?
Fantastic!
Replacing bad fats with healthier fats like those in canola or vegetable oil is good for your heart. Take up the challenge for good health because the you of the future will say,
fantastic!
Visit heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info proudly supports the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
I'm Diane Lees, and we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We are going to move on and talk with Shannon Galpin. Shannon lives in Breckenridge, Colorado, but spends a lot of her time in Afghanistan. As I told you at the beginning of the show, Shannon was featured on Brian Williams' NBC Nightly News Making a Difference segment last week, and I found her and got her to talk with us this evening about her new organization, Mountain to Mountain, talking about women in Afghanistan who are riding bicycles. Shannon, thank you for joining me this evening.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, you know, I came across the NBC Nightly News piece, Making a Difference, last week, and we actually reported on that piece last week about your work with the Afghani Girls Cycling Team, and I absolutely wanted to talk to you about that and about your nonprofit organization. Tell me how you became involved with these young girls in Afghanistan.
Well, it was a pretty unusual process because Afghanistan is one of the few countries where women are not allowed to ride bicycles. And I've been working in Afghanistan with my nonprofit, Mountain to Mountain, for the past 5 years. Never have we seen a woman on a bike or a girl on a bike. It's kind of like the last taboo. You've got more women running for parliament than you have riding bicycles.
Wow.
Yeah. And there's a few people that live in Kabul that knew, you know, that I'm a biker, and I have mountain biked often in Afghanistan to push on that gender barrier. And so they introduced me to one of the men's national team cyclists, who's a young man named Ashraf Ghani. And he then introduced me to the coach and introduced me to the girls.
So before we actually talk about the news piece, which was just fascinating to me, I know you won a National Geographic Award, and I know that bicycling is sort of woven throughout your work with Mountain to Mountain and the outreach that you do. Tell me about the award and about M2M, and then we're going to get back to these young girls who are actually starting to race their bikes in Afghanistan.
Yeah, definitely. The last November, National Geographic chose me as one of their 2013 Adventurers of the Year. They pick 10 adventurers worldwide each year.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. It came out of completely left field. I was beyond shocked when they called me and told me. And I was in Afghanistan riding my bike. And they nominated me, one, because of the barrier-breaking work that I've done on a bike and off with Mountain to Mountain. But the fact that I was the first woman to mountain bike in Afghanistan piqued them and kind of hooked them. But then I was very touched. They really supported and really wrote about more the work that I was doing with women and girls and just voice and culture. So they recognized the last 5 years that I've been working in Afghanistan. And the timing of it was perfect because it was that trip that I happened to meet these young women.
So tell us about Mountain to Mountain, MTM.org.
So Mountain to Mountain was essentially my baby that I launched in 2007. And my goal was to look at empowering women and girls in conflict zones, looking at where women's rights were the worst, where women often didn't have a voice, and looking at ways that I could create value or show women's value through education, arts, and sports, and looking at really tackling the issue of gender equity from a really unique way that wasn't really being done by a lot of other international aid organizations. And it's a one-woman show. It's me for the last 5 years hustling and scrappling to, you know, get the funding for projects. And at the same time, really the part where the bike came in was that I was fascinated that here was a country where women couldn't ride, and yet as a foreign woman, I had this unique opportunity to ride a bike and challenge some gender barriers because I was considered an honorary man.
That was going to be my next question. So the fact that you were a woman, do you have to like cover your head and cover your arms and ride as if you are a woman? Or you just said they sort of made you an honorary man, which is kind of very cool, I guess.
It's a very interesting thing, yeah, because you're kind of straddling this gender barrier like I've never done in any other way or any other country. In Saudi Arabia, if you're a woman, you're a woman. If you come to Saudi Arabia as a woman, you have to wear the abaya. You're dressed in black. You have the same rules. And in Afghanistan, if you are a obviously foreign-looking woman, while in some ways, obviously, that can make me a target, for the most part, it has opened up an enormous amount of access because I'm treated as an equal by the men, but I have full access to the women because I am a woman. And so it's been fascinating that things like riding a bike, which is quite a simple thing, it's really... something that I did because I'm a biker on my days off in Afghanistan, you know, to show that women can ride, but also to show America how beautiful Afghanistan is. And I dress in a collection of long pants, long skirts, long tunic, and a headscarf. It's sweltering, but because I'm typically riding to invoke conversation versus a training ride, my goal is to be able to step off the bike and look like I would if I was having a meeting. And so I ride in a lot of Patagonia. I joke that Patagonia's clothes that repel dirt, dust, and feces the best.
It's an interesting way of putting it.
Yeah, so, I don't know if they like that tagline.
Well, you know what? I think Patagonia would be proud to know what you're doing, and they probably do. What brought you to Afghanistan in the first place?
It really came down to a leap of faith. When I launched Mountain to Mountain, I chose to work in the country that is repeatedly ranked the worst place in the world to be a woman.
Okay.
And it was really that simple.
So you came across these young girls who are now racing in the country. How old are these girls and how many of them are there approximately?
Well, so there's approximately 12 that are on the national team that might have shifted since my last visit.
Okay.
I'll find out in a few weeks. But there's approximately 12. But what the coach told me was that there's another group up in the north in another province. And so he's looking at, his estimate was there's about 60 women on bikes. And that's 60 women riding bikes in a country that does not allow that. But yet these particularly, especially these 12 women, I mean, they're riding very publicly. They are part of the national team, which means should they get support, should they have better gear, better access to racing outside of their country, you know, more training, bike handling skills, experience, these are women that could represent their country in the Olympics. And that has a bigger impact than anything else. It changes the whole taboo around biking.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Shannon Galpin. She's in Breckenridge, Colorado. She's going to head back to Afghanistan. Are you going back to Kabul?
I am. I'll be all around the country, but I always I'll be focused in Kabul because of the women that we're following.
Right. When you leave in 3 weeks and you catch up with these women again, I noticed in the Making a Difference piece on NBC's Nightly News that there was one young girl in particular who was sort of the leader of this group. And her goal is to carry the Afghani flag in the 2016 yeah. Olympics, which I think is awesome because, you know, there was the first African mountain biker to do it in 2012. What do you think her chances are in 2016?
Well, I actually talked with a good friend of mine, Dr. Alan Lim, who
yes.
has worked with a lot of pros. So Alan is a big, big supporter of Mountain to Mountain and of me, and I'm incredibly grateful to have them in my corner. And he and I were talking about these women, and having not focused on the Olympics in terms of what does it take to represent your country, we were talking about, you know, really what does he think that would take? And, you know, they have the biggest obstacle beyond their skill set, beyond, you know, physiology and beyond equipment and beyond training is can they have access to get enough points? Which was something I did not know anything about. And so we had a real brief overview, which I'm going to be talking with the women and the coach when I go back. Essentially, the strongest two or three women, there would have to be a way to get them to train and race in either Europe or the U.S.
Yeah, they need points.
Yeah.
Right.
Right now, they're only racing in India and Pakistan, and that's giving them experience, and it's certainly building up their confidence on a bike and their handling skills, but it won't actually get them the points. And so that's something that we're talking about. And that Alan is very supportive of and wanting to plug into and help if that's something that's possible.
So one of the questions that just came up for me was about the kind of bikes. Are we talking road or are we talking mountain biking?
No, these girls are all roadies.
Aha. Aha. What are they riding? What kind of bikes are they riding?
Well, you know, it's kind of a mishmash.
Yeah.
Not all of them own their own bikes, but there's some old Bianchis, there's an old Giant, there's a kind of a mishmash of bikes that sometimes are shared from brothers or male family members. And good road bikes for anyone, male or female, is almost impossible. And so that's something that we're trying to rally with the bike sponsor, is finding someone who's willing to donate a fleet of bikes, you know, 12 for the men, 12 for the women. Because as they've talked about it, you know, they liken it to, here we are trying to break these barriers. We're wanting to race, but we're racing on Corollas. In Toyota Corollas while everybody else is racing in Ferraris.
Right, right. Sure, sure.
So
well, you know, I always say if you're really good on the lousy bike, you're going to be awesome on the really good
exactly.
bike.
Exactly. It's kind of like skiing. All the East Coast skiers that grew up skiing ice.
Right.
You know, they come to, when it gets snow, they're way better at harbors than any of us.
Interesting. So part of the piece that I did watch had a guy named, I hope I get this right, Abdul Siddiqui.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And he is the trainer. Now, is he training both the women and the men?
He is. He's an interesting character because he's actually known as a biker. He has a history of biking in Afghanistan, which is unusual because there hasn't been a men's team either. The men's team is just as new as the women, practically. And he formed and is coaching this group of young men. But his daughter wanted to ride, and he was very open-minded about that and realized that as women are becoming more involved in sports in Afghanistan, and some women have represented Afghanistan in the last Olympics, that this was something he wanted to support. And so right now he's handling both teams. And I know that while he's willing to do that, at the same time, it would be amazing to be able to get a female coach or at least some female mentorship. That would make the access a lot better because these girls are, they're technically, of marriageable age. They're late teens, early 20s. That's an age where there's typically a lot of segregation between teachers, coaches, mentors, but based on gender.
Do you think that these 12 or 15 women and even the women in the north of where you are going to see their lives differently, or will they actually come back to Afghanistan and then sort of slide back into the old way of life? Is this a way to move out of all this tradition?
Well, I think it's one step. And for me, when I look at Afghanistan, I really look at the longer picture because, there's a philosophy when you look at change, real systemic change takes a generation, which is technically 21.9 years. And I look at all the work I do as sowing a seed. And I look at these women as planting that first seed, where it is going to take a generational shift for women to be accepted riding bikes. These are trailblazers. These are women who are literally risking their lives to ride a bike.
Right.
And much like women in the late 1800s and early 1900s in the U.S., the issue is coming down to morality and promiscuity. I read this great book, Wheels of Change, that was about the turn of the century and women starting to ride bikes in their petticoats.
Susan Macy's book?
I believe it is.
Yeah, Wheels of Change, yeah.
And I remember her saying in that book, at one point, they're talking about how these women were viewed, and they were viewed as immoral and
right.
promiscuous.
Right.
It's exactly the same thing.
Hmm.
You can't label it as Islamic or religious or Afghan. I mean, you look at what that was happening in the U.S. 100 years ago. So there's no reason that the bike, as it is so much a symbol of freedom, I think couldn't start to sow those same changes over time. But it will take time. And I think that much like it became kind of integrally tied with the women's suffrage movement in the U.S., it is something that could be tied in Afghanistan as well. And these girls are taking the risk. They're the trailblazers. They're the ones that will take the brunt of this, as the women who run for parliament do, and the women that break barriers in lots of other ways. But they're the ones that show the example that women can do this.
I think it's awesome. I think what you're doing is awesome. And that's the last thing I want to talk about. You're doing more than just working with people or the women in Afghanistan. Tell us about your U.S. program, what you want to do for women here at home.
Well, yeah, I would love to talk about strength in numbers. This program was based off of the last 5 years of working in Afghanistan. And some of the home truths that I saw when I was looking at my own country and my own home state of North Dakota and where I live now in Colorado, and human trafficking and sex trafficking and gender violence and the predominance of rape and this ongoing rape culture and conversation that's happening after Steubenville. I wanted to look at empowering the voice of women in the U.S. that had been, quote unquote, victimized. In the same way that I look at Afghan women as not victims, I look at them as the potential solutions to the issues of gender violence and women's rights and change in their communities. It's the same thing here. I look at women who have been labeled victims actually are the potential solutions. They have endured much. They have survived much. They have a wellspring of strength. And so I wanted to look at raising their voices and creating an army of women and using the bike as the catalyst. So the women in the U.S. Will be coming together in camps, mountain bike camps, where they'll be mountain biking and stand-up paddle boarding and building camaraderie. All of them who have either experienced rape, gender violence, trafficking, but that are women that want to affect change. They just necessarily don't know how yet, or they haven't used their voice yet. So we're bringing together these incredibly strong women to rally and look at how they literally could peddle a revolution and how we could use women like myself that have been victims of violence actually look at us as not victims, but as solutions and as leaders.
With that in mind, you know, it's sort of like mind-blowing. I'm just sort of sitting here going, wow, this is pretty amazing, because it's so timely. It's so in everybody's face right now. Tell my listeners how they can learn about Mountain to Mountain, learn about what you're doing in Afghanistan, and see if maybe they want to help, learn what you're going to be doing here in the States. How can they find you?
The best way to find us is mountaintomountain.org. That's mountain with the number 2, mountain.org. Has kind of an overview of what we've done and what we are doing. Certainly, if any listener wanted to help support getting the gear over to the women, we have a donation, online donation. We're a 501c3, you know, nonprofit. We need help getting the gear over. We have an enormous amount of bikes and a few hundred pounds worth of cycling gear that we've collected for the men's and the women's team. We need help to get that over in a few weeks. And it definitely has a little sneak peek. That's where we'll be posting some of our blogs and our videos. We're making a film about the women's national team, so Afghan Cycles. And you can follow Mountain to Mountain, Afghan Cycles, or Shannon Galpin on Facebook. And that will have a lot of links to what we continue to do and sharing photos and videos from the upcoming trip.
Well, we will post those links to the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page, to the Outspoken Cyclist blog, and we will follow what you're doing. And I just think what you're doing is amazing and wonderful. And I am so happy to have been able to talk with you.
Thank you. It means the world to have your support.
You are so welcome. Keep up the great work. And we'll check back in with you maybe at the end of the season. How's that?
That sounds perfect.
Have a great night, Shannon. Thank you so much. All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Shannon Galpin, who runs mountaintomountain.org, spoke with us from her home in Breckenridge, Colorado. We are going to move right on out to Petaluma, California, and talk with Ben Sarazen, the owner of Yuba Cargo Bikes. Good evening, Ben. Thanks for joining me on the show.
Good evening. How are you?
I am really well, and it's nice to talk with you. Last week, we spoke with Paul Tomei of Gates Carbon Drive, and he said we just had to talk with Ben from Yuba Bicycles. And I was especially excited because we never talk about cargo bikes, and I think it's really a cool idea. So let's begin with Ben's history. I think your backstory is interesting. You were born in France.
That's correct. I was born in Alsace, in the east part of France, right next to the German border.
And growing up, tell us about your exposure to bikes, because it was long and forever.
So what was interesting about growing up in Alsace, which is, if you people are familiar with Alsace, it's right next to Germany. And the German culture of bicycle for transportation is pretty strong. So we'll go to Germany quite often, and we'll see a lot of people riding their bikes for transportation, and that was pretty inspiring as a, you know, as a kid or as a teenager to see that bicycle culture. And I also grew up next to Strasbourg in France, which is right on the Rhine River, and during the 90s was the best city for cycling and commuting in France, and that really inspired me later on to push the use of bicycles as a tool for transportation and mobility within a city.
So your dad began importing mountain bikes sometime in the mid-80s?
Yeah, so that's a funny story. In 1984, my dad, I can't remember how it happened, I was 10 years old at the time, found the first mountain bikes that landed in France. I guess they landed in late 83, and I decided to buy a lot of them and start renting them, and was trying to sell them. And he got a lot of pushback from the existing dealer and retail chain. And a lot of people say, this thing is never going to work. It's not going to go anywhere. So it was an interesting adventure when I was a kid, for sure.
It's interesting because I thought the mountain bike wouldn't go anywhere either. And I was also wrong. It turned out to be a big deal. It's still a big deal.
I know. And I talked to Gary Fisher once at a bike show, and he was telling me the first time he went to the show in Cologne in Germany, the IFMA show, And he went there with the first mountain bikes. He was there for 5 or 6 days, and he talked to one person.
And, wow.
And which is funny, because at the end of the day, the mountain bike saved the industry, the bike industry in the United States and also in Germany. I mean, in the 90s, mountain bikes were like the biggest thing in Germany. You will, you know, everyone in the mountain bike.
Exactly. Exactly. That is so true. So you also have done a fair bit of world traveling. And we're able to see all kinds of cultures using bicycles. What put you on the road? When did you do all this traveling? Where did you go?
So, I've always loved the outdoor, and I used my bike a lot for exercise, mountain bike or road bikes, and I did a lot of kayaking, whitewater kayaking. And at one point, I got to a place in my studies where I wanted to. Felt I needed to see a little bit what was out there before studying more. And that's when I decided to take a break from studying and my career as a competitive kayaker, and to hit the road and travel with my kayak. And I ended up traveling through the United States, South America, and Africa. And it was pretty eye-opening.
I'll bet. I'll bet. So you kayaked all these different areas, rivers, whatever?
Yeah, so I kind of kayaking in places from, you know, Peru to southern Patagonia to, you know, the Nile in Africa and all those places.
So what made you come back to the United States to live when you had this sort of continental lifestyle?
So that was the interesting part. Like, I came here first to Whitewater Kayak in beautiful California, and I met a lot of people. I enjoyed the lifestyle. I thought it was very interesting. And then I went back to Europe, and I, you know, wanted to, you know, had this idea of connecting the use of bicycles for transportation and being able to carry things. You know, when I was traveling through the third world, I'll notice that people were sometimes trying to carry things on a mountain bike, like bags of rice or jug of waters, and the bikes were just not properly designed for that. And so I tried to carry my kayak on the bike or try to carry a passenger. And I was like, well, maybe there's a way to create a product, to design a product that can be a little more suited to multipurpose, to carry things on the back of a bicycle.
So you went from kayaking to bicycle manufacturing.
Pretty much, yeah. And bicycle manufacturing was really a way for me to bridge the gap between staying healthy and fit and also trying to do something that's like a solution for environmental and social issues that will that the world was encountering at the time.
So you started Yuba Bikes, and they are cargo bikes. And I looked at them carefully online, and they don't look so different from some of the European sort of Dutch-style bikes. But I know that they are. You decided to just focus on cargo bikes. How did you come up with the name Yuba?
So Yuba, the Yuba is a fantastic river and a fantastic area here in Northern California. And because we wanted to have to be able to reach people from different continents and things, we wanted to name fairly easy and short. And that was just a place, a physical place that really inspired me personally, that I, you know, that I love, and I thought it would be make a good name for a bike company.
Yeah, it does. I think it does. It's easy to remember, and it starts with a Y, which is very cool. So Bicycling Magazine actually named one of your bikes right alongside of a lot of road bikes as being a very cool bike. It's called the Boda Boda. What does Boda Boda mean?
So Boda Boda, that comes from all the travels I've done, and Boda Bodas are bicycle taxis in Africa. So what do I mean by bicycle taxis? You can be in a small town or a big town in Africa, and you've got guys hanging out by the side of the road with their bicycle, and you can hire them to take you to the other side of town or a few blocks away, or restaurant owners hire them to go buy a bag of rice at the market or buy some, you know, sweet potatoes or bananas or whatever you can buy or have to, that things that need to get carried on the bicycle. So Boda Bodas are actually bicycle taxis, delivery and people bikes in Africa.
So What is it about that bicycle that got Bicycling Magazine's attention? What was so... Yeah, so there are other cargo bikes out there, but the Bota Bota was in particular something they really gave, thumbs up to.
I think the main reason it's the lightest and most compact cargo bike out there. So you have the capacity to carry people, passenger, and you can carry a stand-up paddleboard if you wanted. You can carry... fair amount of groceries, you can carry tools. So it's a very practical bicycle, and at the same time, it's compact. So you know, it doesn't take much more room than a regular commuter bike, and it's light. It's only 35 pounds for a cargo bike, and I think that makes it very attractive to people from, you know, like the mom wants to take her kids to the school, or just a single city dweller who just needs to get groceries for the market.
So are you selling to the customer, or are you selling to a dealer network?
We are selling to a dealer network that's very extensive. It goes from, you know, Seattle to Los Angeles and Florida to Maine. And we do sometimes sell direct to individuals who don't have a dealer nearby. But we're about 130 dealers in the United States.
Oh, that's a nice number. That's very nice. So I have sort of a general question for you. What do you see as the future of transportation cycling in the U.S.?
I remember, you know, about 10 years ago, people had really not much of a belief into bikes being used for transportation in North America. And every day we see people who are like, you know, I really want to take my kids to school on a by bicycle. I really like to be able to do my groceries by bike. And bicycle coalitions all around the country are doing a fantastic job, you know, adding bike path, educating children with a program like Safe Route to School. And the more bike path there are, the more people are going to start using their bike for transportation. And, you know, it's been seen in Portland, in San Francisco, in New York. So it's really growing, and I think we're going to see way more people using their bikes for transportation here in North America.
I hope you're right. So if you would be so kind as to tell our listeners how they might learn about Yuba Bikes, what is your website?
Yeah, so our website is yubabikes.com. So it's spelled YubaBikes.com. And on the website, you can find all the information you need about the Bota Bota or the Mundo cargo bike, and see stories of cyclists riding the bike, using the bike for various purposes, such as cooking tacos or doing bird observation and so forth.
Well, I think they are nice-looking bikes. You don't have a huge line to choose from, which I like. I like the idea of just having a few choices instead of like 3 million choices. So I wish you a lot of luck with Yuba Bikes, and I appreciate you spending time talking with me this evening.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you, and I wish you a beautiful evening.
Thanks. Okay, Ben. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Ben Sarazen spoke with me about his company Yuba Bikes from Petaluma, California. It's a beautiful place. If you've never been there, we drove through it last year when we were at NABS. I really like it a lot. Well, that's all we have time for this evening on The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you have a great week and can get out and ride. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we have a Facebook page. You can go out and say, hey, we like you. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.